we're looking at the character of God, or as we sometimes say, the attributes of God. It's not a word I like, but it's a word we use to describe the different aspects to God's character. And there are two kinds of these attributes, which I suspect some of you, they'll be familiar to some of you, maybe not to others, this distinction. Firstly, that there are attributes or characteristics of God that can be God's alone, that he cannot share with us at all. He can't communicate them to us. And there are four of these. There is what we call God's independence. Only God is totally independent and self-sufficient. He came from nothing. He needs nothing. He's not dependent on anybody or anything else. He relies on nobody. We are quite different. And of course, we can never be like that. We can't share that at all. That's something which only God can be totally self-sufficient. The second thing is his unchangeableness. God not only doesn't change, he can't change. If he could change, he'd be less than perfect, because if he is perfect, then of course he can't change. So he's unchangeable, immutable, sometimes we use that word. And that's a great, you know, he changes not. The third one is his infinity. He is without limits, without bounds. There are no boundaries to God, either in time, because he's eternal, or in space, because, well, he just extends forever and ever and ever. There are no boundaries to him. So his infinity, including his eternity, are something which we can never share, of course. We could never be like that in any way. And then finally, which is maybe a surprise to you, what we call his unity, or his inner unity. Sometimes this is called his simplicity. God has no parts. God is not made up of different things joined together. The Father, the Son, and the Spirit are not three persons joined together. There are no joins in God. He's not his holiness and his love and his wisdom and his power stuck together. There is one perfect whole that is God. So when we talk about his attributes, his wisdom, his power and his knowledge and so forth, really we're looking at different aspects of the one whole, really. And that's, again, that's something we can't be. We are body and soul, apart from anything else. We're made up of parts, and so we're not like God in that sense. So those four things which God can only be, only God can be. But then there's other things that he shares with us in some measure. And these are familiar to us. His holiness, his righteousness, his goodness, his love, his wisdom, his knowledge and power. Although, of course, only God can have those in a particular way. Knowledge, for example, we can know some things, but only God is omniscient. Power, we have some strength, but only God is omnipotent. Only God is perfectly good, wise, and righteous. But nonetheless, he does tell us, for example, to be holy, as he is holy. So there is some way in which we can we can share these things of God. We can partake of his nature in that sense, in a way we can't do with his infinity and eternity and his unchangeableness and so forth. So these moral qualities of God we can share. Indeed, we must do, because we're made in his image. And so we are to grow back more into that image. And this evening I want to begin with and look at holiness, which some call the attribute of attributes. Packer received some criticism for not devoting a full chapter to holiness in his book Knowing God. with some justification, although he does talk about God's majesty, and he does mention holiness in a number of places. But it would have been perhaps good if he could have devoted a proper chapter to God's holiness. And it's something we are told to be. God is holy, but we are told to be holy as I am holy, he says in Leviticus, and Peter quotes that in his first letter. Now, there are two human reactions to God's holiness in the Bible, and I've called one danger. Danger. How do we think about God's holiness? Well, for example, I'll just work through a few Old Testament passages, and these tell us something about a human reaction to God's holiness. In Exodus chapter 3, the burning bush, we read that Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. That's same as Sinai. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, and he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near. You see, don't come near. I wonder if we think of God saying that to us sometimes. Don't come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And then he goes on to say, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. So there's holiness of God, and it spells danger. It spells don't approach. Then there's another well-known incident in the book of Leviticus. This was where they were consecrating the priests and the tabernacle. And in chapter 9 of Leviticus, at verse 22, we read, Aaron lifted up his hands toward the people and blessed them, and he came down from offering the sin offering and the burnt offering and the peace offerings. And Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting, and when they came out, they blessed the people, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the pieces of fat on the altar, and when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it and laid incense on it and offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, This is what the Lord has said. Among those who are near me, I will be sanctified. In other words, I will be hallowed, I will be revered as holy. And before all the people, I will be glorified. And Aaron held his peace. So here are Nadab and Abihu. They have a bright idea. They see the fire of heaven coming down on Aaron's sacrifice. And they go, oh, let's do that. So they offer this unauthorized fire, strange fire. And, of course, God says no. You know, very, very strict judgment. Very immediate judgment. Let's look at another one. In 2 Samuel. Chapter 6. And this is where David is taking the Ark of God into a tent that he has made, erected in Jerusalem for it. And we read in chapter 2 Samuel, chapter 6, verse 5, And David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with songs and lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah put out his hand to the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him down there because of his error, and he died there beside the ark of God. And David was angry because the Lord had broken out against Uzzah, and that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of the Lord. So it's interesting. Again, you see, that's something that shocks us. Here is a man who is a Levite, and surely you don't want the ark of God falling into the mud. You don't want the ark of God falling onto the road. Why is Uzzah so strictly and severely treated? Well, there's a number of things. One is that the Ark of God should never have been on a cart anyway, because when you look at Numbers, chapter 4, it should be carried. Chapter 4 of Numbers, verse 15, that the sons of Kohath shall come to carry these, but they must not touch the holy things, lest they die. These are the things of the tent of meeting that the sons of Kohath are to carry. And so the whole of the equipment for the tabernacle, the furniture, was to be covered up, and it was to be carried on poles by the Levites. It was not to be simply dumped on an ox cart, and it certainly wasn't to be touched. Uzzah knew that. He just didn't take it seriously. I wonder if that's true of us sometimes. We know God's law, but we just don't take it seriously. We think, oh, well, God will forgive. That's his business. But here is something showing that God indeed is a consuming fire. Then, of course, you have the passage I read at the beginning from Isaiah chapter 6. You have the holiness of God, and you have the seraphim, the burning ones, and even they are covering their eyes, and they're covering their feet, and they're covering their faces. And they're saying, holy, holy, holy is the Lord. And the foundations of the threshold shake. House is filled with smoke. And what happens to Isaiah? He said, woe is me, for I am lost. For I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. So there is something where Isaiah... Not only, as somebody said it, not only did Isaiah come to know God there, Isaiah comes to know Isaiah there. That in the presence of the holiness of God, Isaiah really sees what he is for the first time. A corrupt sinner. And he literally is disintegrates. I'm an unclean man. I dwell in the midst. I am lost. I am lost. Woe is me. So there you have four incidents that show the holiness of God as a danger. You know, the early Israelites were taught that they would not be able to see God face to face. Moses was allowed to see the back parts of God and had God speak to him and describe his goodness, but not to see his face. So the holiness of God then is a fearful thing. It spells death to transgressors. Death is the just penalty for sin. When we read the Old Testament and we see that there are numerous offences for which there was a death penalty, perhaps we think, well, this is corrupt. This is an old society. This is something which we would never do today. And we don't, but... When the principle of it is this, that when the death is legislated as the penalty for certain offences, do we realise that that's actually a limitation of the death penalty? That in fact all of us deserve to die, right? That all of us deserve to die for our sin. That God giving us continuing life is itself mercy, is itself kindness of God. So when we think it's, you know, oh yeah, okay, 30 death penalties. In fact, the English legal system was far worse than that. It had death penalty for all kinds of things. The Bible never even gave the death penalty for until the early 1800s. But I think it just helps to see that how gracious God is in the light of his holiness, which does demand death. God, our God, is a consuming fire, as the writer to the Hebrews says. But if holiness is danger, it's also a delight. And this is a strange thing about holiness. For example, in Psalm 99 is one of some others which could say, Psalm 99 is a hymn of praise. Verse 3, let them praise your great and awesome name. Holy is he. Okay, so you have this God who strikes people dead, and we might be puzzled and say he's being a bit harsh there, but he's also the same God whom you praise because he's holy. Verse 5, exalt the Lord our God, worship at his footstool, holy is he. Verse 9, exalt the Lord our God and worship at his holy mountain, for the Lord our God is holy. And you'll find in the Psalms that there is delight in God's holiness. And that's a true feature of Christian worship. So just remember these two aspects. What holiness means to us human beings. Danger and delight. I'll come back to them later. But what is holiness? How do we begin to define holiness? Now, Isaiah 6, verse 3, God is three times holy, thrice holy. Holy, holy, holy. In the Hebrew, that reflects fullness, perfection of holiness, but also an emphasis on holiness. He is holy, he is perfectly holy, but he is holy above all. What does holiness mean? Terry Johnson, in a book called The Identity and Attributes of God, says holiness applies to all God's attributes. It's what characterizes God above all. It's his defining and distinguishing characteristic. J.I. Packer says it specifies everything about God that sets him apart from us and makes him an object of awe, adoration, and dread. Think of that. It specifies everything about God, or signifies everything about God, that sets him apart from us and makes him an object of awe, adoration, and dread. It is, says Packer, the godness of God. It covers all aspects of his transcendent greatness. Now, I don't like using big words, but transcendent is one of those words sometimes you have to use. It means, well, I'll come on to what it means later on, but it's one of those words you can't avoid using, because it's describing God as being over and against us, as it were, different from us. His greatness and his moral perfection. So it covers all aspects of his transcendent greatness and moral perfection, and it characterizes all his attributes. So that's the picture. One of the Puritans, Stephen Charnock, wrote a famous book about the doctrine of God. And he says this in one place: his justice is a holy justice. His wisdom is a holy wisdom. His arm of power is a holy arm. His truth or promise, a holy promise. Holy and true go hand in hand. His name, which signifies all his attributes in conjunction, is holy. So you get the picture. You get the picture that everything God is holy. Holiness describes God. It's the godness of God. And there are two main ideas in this holiness. There's separateness, first. Separateness. And that's where that word transcendent comes in. Transcendent means he's above and beyond. Transcends. He literally, some of the climbs above, but he doesn't climb, of course. He is above and beyond us. I wonder if when we think of God and we think of knowing God, we immediately think of ways in which we are like God and which God is like us. And that's not wrong. But we must give equal place too to the fact that God is unlike us. We have to remember that. He is not a man, for example, that he should repent or change. His thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are not our ways. And that there is something I find rather of a relief, really, and a delight in thinking of God not being like us. He is this transcendent. And the word holy means initially separate. Holy things are separated for God's use. Think of the Old Testament. There is holy ground. There's holy assemblies holy Sabbath, holy nation, holy oil, holy jubilee, holy censers, holy bread, holy city, holy place, the holy of holies, holy people. God is the Holy One. God's name is, I haven't counted this, but I take it on trust, qualified by holy, the adjective in Old Testament, more than by all other descriptions put together. I find that fascinating, that whatever God is described as, he's more often called holy than by all other descriptions put together. And of course, the book of Isaiah is a key example of that. But of course, things set apart are also pure. And this is where the second meaning of holy, which we perhaps initially tend to think of at first, comes in. The idea of purity, morally pure and perfect and free from all evil. That's not the initial meaning of holy. The idea of separateness is first, but because separateness implies purity. For example, the oil for the tabernacle and the temple had to be made out of special ingredients. Nobody else could make that oil. You couldn't do anything else but make oil with those things. And that was holy oil. There's a separation between the clean and the unclean. So inevitably, the idea of separateness, which is the original meaning of holiness, begins to bring in the meaning of the idea of purity, moral cleanliness, freedom from all evil. And so those two ideas, separateness and purity. How does God reveal his holiness then? How does God reveal his holiness? There are four ways, I think, one can say God reveals his holiness. Firstly, in his law. His law. God is holy, but he makes it known in some way. What his law? It's the rule of God's holiness. It reflects his character. How do we manifest holiness when we're commanded to be holy? Well, we obey the law, which, as Paul says, is holy and righteous and good. Okay, so that's Paul in Romans 7, verse 12. And so the law is holy, righteous and good, and we are to obey it. And the righteous requirement of the law is fulfilled in us by the Holy Spirit. Unholiness is to break God's law and to treat it as little account. Think of Nadab and Abihu. They weren't just to go and take any fire they wanted to into God's temple and just set the incense alight. That wasn't what God had allowed them to do. That was just their own bright idea. And so, you know, they took an utterly arrogant attitude towards the law of God. Uzzah, we might think he's well-intentioned trying to stop the ark, but it would have been better for the ark to crash onto the ground than for Uzzah to break God's law. He made the value judgment that it was better for him to touch it than to stop it falling. I mean, he shouldn't have been on the ark at all, of course. But he then compounded sin by breaking a second law. And so I think, again, these things teach us that we need to think of God's laws as those which we should respect. Now, these are ceremonial laws, of course, and the moral laws are much more important. King Uzziah, who's not the same as Uzzah, by the way. Uzzah was a Levite at the time of King David. Uzziah was the king who died just before Isaiah was called as a prophet, 200 years later after David. And Uzziah went into the temple. King Uzziah went into the temple. You read this in 2 Chronicles chapter 26. And he took some incense and he burned incense in the temple. And he offered incense, and he was not supposed to do that because he wasn't a priest. He was only a king. The priests went in after him and bravely confronted him. If he listened to them, he would have repented and been able to come away, but he didn't. He got very angry, and God made him a leper. And again, it was this kind of arrogant attitude towards the law of God. But the law of God is for us to obey as the rule of holiness, not for us to do as we like. So that's one way God reveals his holiness, is by his law. The second is his attitude to good and evil, which is not just his law, but the way he expresses himself. He says he loves righteousness, Psalm 33, verse 5. And he hates sin, Amos 5, 21. God uses very strong language. I hate, I despise your feasts, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Now, God isn't saying he hated the feasts that he had ordained. No. What he is saying is the way that the Israelites were celebrating these feasts was again showing contempt for God's moral law. They were living immoral lives, and they thought that by celebrating with the feasts and the rituals of their religion, they would be all right with God. And it was these feasts were being used to cover up sin. And God says he hates those feasts. He hates that kind of hypocrisy, that deceitfulness. Sin is described by awful things, so horrible things in the Bible. It's described as an open grave. Now you think of that. It's described as a snake's poison. It's described as the vomit of a dog. And the mire of a pig. It's described by Ezekiel as crude harlotry, the self-selling of a prostitute. So when you see these pictures that the Bible uses of sin, you can see how it's odious to God. I mean, those things are odious to any right-thinking person. Well, they only just give us a picture of how odious sin is to God. And I wonder if we need to ask ourselves, are we shocked more by God's justice than by his grace? What are our attitudes to good and evil? Do we sometimes take grace and kindness of God for granted? We expect him to be kind. We expect him to do good things. We expect him to be nice. And we find justice quite astonishing, like these stories of Ozah and Nadab and Abihu. We find the justice of God, the holiness of God, the righteousness of God to be amazing, and we find grace to be rather commonplace. Does that perhaps tell us that our idea of God has become diluted, watered down? Kind old man in the sky. So God reveals his holiness in his law and his attitude to good and evil. Thirdly, in his people. We are to be a holy people. Exodus 19, verse 6. We are to be a nation of priests, a holy people. We are to reflect God in our lives. Paul says in Ephesians chapter 1 that we have been called, elect, called, redeemed to be holy. That's the end purpose of it. Salvation. Holiness. Be holy as I am holy, Peter says, repeating Leviticus 11, verse 4 and 5. Sorry, 45. So there is obedience there. And our holiness is to reflect God. And God is to reveal himself through this nation of priests as he wanted Israel to be. He wanted Israel to look to be a nation on whom people would look and say, their God is like that. Can people look on us and do they get a reflection of God? We are to obey God and we're to imitate God as well. Ephesians 5:1, be imitators of God. Jonathan Edwards, American theologian in the 18th century, said, A true love to God must begin with a delight in his holiness. A true love to God must begin with a delight in his holiness. It's interesting the reason he gives for that. He says, if you love God's holiness, you love him truly for who he is, not for anything he might do for you. I wonder if you've thought about that. If you love God's holiness, you love him for who he is, not for anything he might do for you. Because God's holiness doesn't do anything for you. It's not in the sense like his power or his love in that sense. Where we can say we love God's power, we love God's love, because obviously we think they'll do something for us. But God's holiness is not like that. It's his inner character, it's who he actually is. But it's when you love somebody, the inner being of someone, regardless of whether they can do something for you or not, then you really do love them. And to delight in God's holiness is truly to love God. And then the final way he reveals himself is, of course, in his Son, that holy thing that will be in you, Luke 1:35. The holy child conceived by the Spirit in Mary, a lamb without spot or blemish, lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, the priest who is holy, innocent and unstained, Hebrews 7:26. Again, we are to imitate him, 1 Peter 2:21, and imitate God. And of course, in imitating Christ, we're imitating God. So the Son, then, is the perfect revelation and the fulfillment of holiness. So how does God reveal his holiness? His law, his attitude to good and evil. He hates evil, he loves good. In his people, as we reflect God in our lives. And then finally, perfectly, of course, in his Son, Jesus Christ, the Holy One of God. Okay, the last point now. How do we move from danger to delight? Remember that series of passages I gave us at the beginning? How do you move from danger to the delight? How do you move from God being a danger to you to delight? Well, if you go back to Isaiah chapter 6, what happens? Isaiah has learned who God is, something of who God is. The holy, holy, holy Lord God of hosts. He's seen the seraphim singing his praises. He's also learned about himself. I am lost. Woe is me. And that woe is a strong word. It's rather like saying I'm damned. Really. I'm damned. I'm doomed. There's no hope for me. But then what happens? Wow. In verse 6, there is salvation. One of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. So there is an altar there. An altar speaks of sacrifice. And from this altar, the seraphim takes the burning coal. It's interesting that the burning one, the seraphim, still has to use a tongs to pick up the coal. It's hot coal. But with this, he touches Isaiah's mouth. I can never think of that without wincing. He touches Isaiah's mouth. And it's interesting, of course, it's his mouth he especially knows to be sinful, because he has said, I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. And it's his lips that are touched first, that are touched by the coal. Why his lips? Well, possibly because simply that was the uncleanness. God hates uncleanness of speech. It may have been that was Isaiah's particular sin and the sin of people around him. It could be because Isaiah was going to be a prophet, and God wants to emphasize that God can take even a man of unclean lips and make him speak his word. But whatever the reason for that, it's clear that the way he's cleansed is by a coal from the altar. And the angel then declares his cleansing. Behold, he says, this has touched your lips, your guilt is taken away, and your sin atoned for. So how may we move from danger to delight? Well, it's through the cross. It's through the cross. Christ faced that danger like no one ever has. All the judgment and the wrath that we see in that frightened Moses, that struck down Nadab and Abihu and Uzzah, that frightened Isaiah, all that was actually and really poured out on Jesus Christ on the cross. Here is God's holy reaction to sin. God poured out his hatred of sin, his sin that he sees in pictorial language as snake's poison, as vomit, as venom, as harlotry. All of these horrible things. They even make us blush to think of them. And yet Christ was that to God on the cross. Staggering, isn't it? He faced the danger of God's holiness, wearing, as it were, human sin. Human sin was reckoned to him, imputed to him, laid upon him. Willingly, it wasn't just God being cruel to his son. No, willingly, Christ willingly took it on. He took on the task of dying as an atoning sacrifice. And he took it on for our sakes. And think of all that horror of sin piled on Christ. And God hurling forth his wrath against him. That's holiness in action. And the result of that is that we can know God with delight. We can see God. We can rejoice in God. We can enjoy God. This is how the saints of the Old Testament, of course, there are places where Moses delighted and rejoiced in God, even though he also knew him as the God of danger. And we can't neglect that holiness is a danger to sin, and it's a danger to careless Christian living. And it's a danger to people who reject Christ. We worship a God. We must worship God with reverence and awe, because God is a consuming fire, we're told in Hebrews. We can't just take God for granted. But we have this wonderful privilege that we can delight in God, and the danger of ultimate judgment, the danger of ultimate rejection from God, has been removed from his people because Christ took that on the cross. So that is the picture of Isaiah chapter 6, and it's how we can come to know God and be moved, remove from the danger of God's holiness to delighting in him.